You ready?
Get money. That's our thing. We like to get money. That's our thing.
I'd like to convene the House Committee on Business and Labor April 3rd on Friday. We're going to start out with a public hearing on House Bill 3236. So I will open that hearing.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure limits the enforceability of non-competition agreements to 1 year. It applies to those agreements entered into or on after January 1st, 2016. There are no amendments.
Thank you. Representative McLean, would you like to start us out with this bill proposed?
Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee. My name is Mike McLean. I represent House District 55 in the legislature. I proposed this bill and was thankful for Senator Farioli to join me on it, really for one reason. Senator Farioli and I were chatting and talking about what are some of the ways that the lack of innovation, especially in some of the rural areas, and trying to think of state involvement in entrepreneurship and what it would look like when it wasn't typical with regards to tax credits to incent certain investments, state-funded incubators, things like that. And one idea that doesn't cost us anything, at least from the state level, came out of an article I read. I've given a copy of it to Mr. Puckett to put it in the record. But it comes from the Harvard Business Review. It's called What the Two Most Innovation-Friendly States Have in Common. And this study, done by Ann Knott, looked at sectors where you have innovation in a business and it spawns multiple companies. And so they looked at that unique thing that happens, which is a tremendous boost for the economy of a local area and a state, leads to all sorts of benefits. So you've got well-known sectors like, you know, Silicon Valley. We have our Silicon Force and foot apparel and the like. You have different areas that grow up. So when they did this study, they noticed that when you take away all the other factors, there was the two states that had spawned this innovation and where economy had built up and you had entrepreneurs spawn business firms and companies and it just sort of grew up. California and Minnesota ranked the highest, and the two things that they had in common, separating everything out, is that they didn't have non-competition agreements. In other words, they weren't enforced. So they started digging down in that, and they looked and said, well, gosh, it's different weather, it's different taxing policies, different politics. But they found that a lot of the entrepreneurs come from companies, and they have an idea in a certain area, and then they leave that company and start a business in a related area. And some of the talent from the big company may go over with them, may not, may take a while and come over, and that this non-competition agreement and how they treated it was indicative of how quickly and robust you have innovation spawned through entrepreneurism. So I live out in Powell Butte and read stuff like this because I have a big social life. And the one of the things that struck me was that when you look at the other factors about innovation in entrepreneurism, Oregon has a lot of it. And yet we continue to ask this question, why do we lag in incomes? Why is it that we don't have the economy would like to have? And we've had talk about the second paycheck, which we won't digress with, hopefully. But we do have a very old and established rule on covenants not to compete. I have been involved in courts, court cases, as an attorney enforcing them, and I've been on the other side trying to break them, so I'm fairly familiar with them. The law, I think, we leave it up to our circuit court judges to really make this call, and our circuit judges do a very good job, and I think Oregon's law is very reasonable. However, you can restrain through a covenant not to compete if it's done right up to 2 years. And so this bill just does one thing. It says 2 years should be taken down, and by statute we should say a max of 1 year. So if you do everything right, entered into unemployment or bona fide advancements, reasonable within location and time and all of that, nevertheless the maximum would be 1 year. Now, I'm doing this because I would like to see us become more like California, Minnesota with regards to these innovations spawning and entrepreneurism around different sectors. I think it's fantastic what they have going on there now. But I have no studies or intel or no forecasting ability beyond anyone here. So maybe if we went from 2 to 1 year, it would mean nothing. But I thought, you know, what the heck? What's the worst that could happen? Well, maybe we have some talented people who would get to be entrepreneurs or quicker than otherwise. But I'm not, you know, this is an idea, and we're in a legislative session, and we're all looking for ideas to try to increase entrepreneurism and innovation. And so I thought, well, let's talk about this. I think you should have copies. I'd encourage you all to read it. It's very short. The study is that you can dive into is very interesting. But the summary here is very short. So that's why I introduced the bill, and certainly acknowledge that that it would be a change that businesses may not necessarily want. But Oregon is in a situation where status quo, from my standpoint, is not acceptable when we're talking about why we lag behind in other states in incomes. And so I threw this up against the wall, and Chair Holby, you tell me whether it sticks.
Well, thanks for that confidence. I don't know that I'm the sole decider of that, but Representative Evans, a question?
Yes. First of all, I apologize for being late, but I saw the bill came up, so I ran down here. I have a question. I've been actually called about this bill by a couple of different industries and a couple of different small businesses in the industry. And the question is, what about 18 months? There are certain industries that already have 18 months as a standard, and at the risk of trying to make them reduce some of what they're doing, especially in the technological sector, would you be amenable to an 18-month change as opposed to only 1 year?
Chair Holby, Representative Evans, sure. I think when you read the article, and I and you look like a man who reads, and that's actually a line from a movie, but anyway,
when you have a face for radio like I do.
But I'm teasing. I know you read. You and I both had to take very similar courses in our PME stuff, and so I know you read a lot. But read this, and you might be able to reach a different conclusion, and whatever you conclude is fine. I want ultimately to say, if Oregon is doing something that we don't realize could is actually getting in the way of what are all of our common goals, the fact that they came out and realized, hey, this matters,
right.
I just wanted to say to the business committee, I think she's right. I think Ann Knott's right. And 2 years is, I think, too long. 18 months? Sure. A year? I just went with a year. I mean, Minnesota doesn't have any.
Follow up.
I just want to say, again, I just wanted to respond to the business folks that were asking about it, but I want to applaud you for looking at these other factors as well, because as we're trying to compete in the 21st century, as you know, globally, there are not always these types of things in the way of business. So trying to find the best mix, I appreciate you doing that.
Thank you.
Representative Fagan.
So first, just a question, because I don't have the statute in front of me, but Oregon's current non-compete, correct me if I'm wrong, but it just has to be reasonable. And are you saying the courts have found that 2 years is what's reasonable, or is there a statute now that says 2 years?
Chair Holby, Representative Fagan, my understanding is that our statute, which looks like it's ORS 653 and 295, puts a cap of 2 years.
Okay.
In order to be enforceable, there's rules, and reasonableness is the test that the courts determine on whether it can be upheld. Because I put it this way. The default is you cannot restrain trade. So the company seeking to enforce the non-compete has to show that it's enforceable because, A, it was entered into at the time of entry of employment or bona fide advance, or B, it's reasonable and geographic restraint as well as time. And that's a balancing test, et cetera, et cetera. But I think nonetheless, my understanding of the law is nonetheless they can't exceed 24 months.
Follow up. I mean, mostly just a comment. I really appreciate you bringing this forward because, I mean, I haven't been involved in a lot of litigation on this, but I know that the couple times that I have, if I look back now, I think probably a year would not have. So the couple cases I've been involved with, the desire to even litigate the other factors came from the fact that 2 years was just too long, right? So, which, you know, if you're thinking about somebody breaking off from a huge company, wanting to go make a startup, they don't have a lot of money, they have a vision and a dream and an idea and a passion to go be an entrepreneur. The couple of cases I've been involved with, I think if it had been a year, they just wouldn't have litigated. They would have taken that year to get their ducks in a row and kind of get their things going and then been able to launch. But 2 years was just too long, so they decided to litigate the reasonableness and kind of the factors, which is expensive for somebody trying to start a business. It's risky because they're typically litigating against a larger former employer to try and break that agreement. So I think this is a really interesting idea because even though it's only a year less, I think it's a really dramatic, like, I think it's a pretty, I could see why this article makes sense. And I've actually read something, not by the Harvard Business Review, but similar to this. There must be an idea floating around there. Because I think a year, an entrepreneur could go, okay, like, it's going to take me a year anyway to get my, you know, website up and kind of all my stuff before I actually go into business. But 2 years, so I think that even though it's only a year different, I could see just intuitively why that would make a really big difference. I think this is a really interesting idea. Thank you.
Well, Chair Holvey and Representative Fagan, my experience has been that you're right. There is sort of this demarcation of what's worth the fight, and I think it is around a year. And I certainly acknowledge when a company invests in an employee, and especially management level or engineers, people who are really critical to the innovation, and to have that person leave is an economic setback. So I understand the values of non-competes. Going from 24 months to 12, just as far as the maximum they can be enforced, I thought would give us a little look, if we will, in Oregon to say, is there something to this? But as Representative Evans has heard, maybe it should be 18 months. And it may be, and I know Betsy Earls is going to testify, and I highly respect her. And so it may be that we're not ready for it, but perhaps this is something we could push a little bit during an interim or something, we start really analyzing this better, because I think ultimately there is a disconnect in Oregon in that we have these lower incomes. And when you look at these regional areas of innovation that have spawned, their incomes have gone up. And so more income produces communities that can fund the services we'd like to see funded. So anyway, sorry for taking so much time, Chair Hoyle, but...
It's Holvey.
Holvey.
They look a lot alike,
Madam Chair.
So much for that, Bill.
Short points.
You can tell.
And everyone wins.
You rep I deal a lot with every day.
So you may have a social life in Salem, perhaps. I don't know. Thank you. I really appreciate you bringing this forward. The biggest, I was very interested in hearing this bill. I'm glad you brought it forward. I must admit that I was really looking forward to having Senator Farioli testify this morning, because I've been on the other side with sitting there with him up here, and so it was something I had really planned for. So.
Well, Ms. Chair Holvey, if that's what it takes to move the bill, I will get him here.
Well, we'll see. Thank you very much. I want to bring up Betsy Earls and Lana Butterfield, please. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and appearing to talk to you about a few things about non-compete agreements and give you a few things to think about. I think the thing that my members emphasized to me most when we talked about this bill was that the temporal restriction, the time restriction on a non-compete agreement is only one factor of several that courts consider when determining whether or not one is reasonable, a non-compete agreement is reasonable. The other thing that's a very important factor in the balancing test is geography and how wide-ranging the non-compete agreement is. So employers carry an extremely heavy burden of proving that a non-compete agreement is reasonable if they end up in court. And kind of the calculus, among other things, is that if you impose a longer, or if an employer tries to impose a longer period of time on a non-compete agreement, the court really limits the geographical region that the agreement can be imposed in. So, for example, you have a company in downtown Portland that wants to impose one of these agreements, and the agreement only covers, Portland. Then it makes more sense for such an agreement to be perhaps as long as the statute allows, which is 2 years. But if you have a situation where you have a scientist that could work anywhere in the world and a company's competitors are, located, in Asia, the courts in Oregon are not going to allow that employer from Oregon to impose a non-compete agreement of 2 years on the entire world. It's going to be a fairly short one. And, that in and of itself is a problem because most non-compete agreements are written to protect trade secrets, and trade secrets have a much longer life for the most part than 1 year or, even 2 years, really. And it's pretty hard for an employee to say, even if they genuinely mean the best, that they're not going to use the knowledge, scientific or otherwise, that they have gained with working for an employer to the advantage of another company, to a competitor. There's just no way to say, I know how to make that crystal. I know how this company makes that crystal, but I promise not to use that knowledge across the world. Nevertheless, the geographic region is really the most important balancing factor against time when you look at those two things. And the other thing to note is that courts in Oregon have really broad authority to modify non-compete agreements that they see as unreasonable. So they have blue pencil authority, which means basically they can rewrite the agreement right there in court if it's found to be unreasonable based on the factors that they think are most important in what are really very fact-heavy balancing tests. And it depends very much on the specific facts of the case. So we would encourage you not to limit more than is already limited one factor in the entire balance that the court can use to figure out what's reasonable.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here on behalf of the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, or PIA. My association is comprised of very small businesses. They go anywhere from two employees, the mom-and-pop insurance agency, up to maybe 10. So they're very micro businesses. Plus they are comprised of independent insurance agents, meaning that they don't sell for just one company, they sell for many companies, and they don't have the protection that that one company only relationship gives to other kinds of agents. When an independent agency owner begins his business from scratch, he has a very difficult time, he or she, finding new customers. And it takes a long time to build that customer list, and he or she will guard it with his or her life because that's a very valuable asset. It's probably the most valuable thing that they have about their business. And let me talk to you about a subset of these kind of agreements. It's called a non-piracy agreement. And that simply means that the agreement says, don't try and steal my customers for a set period of time within a set geographical limit. We oppose this bill because it is so difficult to get customers and to keep our lists whole. I had an agency owner who was willing to come down and testify before you, but he couldn't at the last moment. But let me read one of his emails. He says, I have had to contest my non-piracy agreements twice in court over the last 30 years. In both cases, the court caused a rogue employee to stop bad behavior and start negotiating in a professional manner. In both cases, our settlement was the past employee could buy their business from us. As I see it, this bill would likely stop that scenario from occurring. 1 year is not very long. If they also included within the definition of allowable multi-year employment restraint agreements to include non-piracy, then I wouldn't have a problem with this bill. So if you do move forward with the bill, we think 18 months would be better than just 1 year, but we would also like you to see you exempt non-piracy lists from or agreements from the bill.
Thank you. Are there non-piracy limits at 2 years? Just
yes.
They're sort of the same thing. They're defined within the non-compete.
Yes, they are. It's on line, I think you said 29 or 28.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel? Ms. Earls, I'll have to check the record, but I think this may be the first time you've testified without using the word opposition.
It's a second.
Right there.
But who's counting?
Number two.
But thank you for noticing.
How soon he forgets.
Well played. It's not quite the way you signed up, but anyway.
We'll have three, but
thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on this? Representative Widener, I do have time if you wanted to call Representative McLean back up for a question before he leaves.
That's okay. We'll let the great leader leave.
Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3236. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 2568.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that creates the Oregon Spirits Board, directs the board to operate a state distilled liquor room, directs the board to create and maintain a long-term strategic plan to guide the allocation of funds and award grants, and establishes the Oregon Spirits Board Fund, with monies in the fund continuously appropriated to the board for its use, directs the OLCC to withhold for payment to the board 1 penny to 4 pennies per bottle of distilled spirit sold, depending on the volume of the bottle. There are two amendments before you. The proposed -2 amendment requires the board to report to the legislature every 2 years. Excuse me. The proposed -4 amendment clarifies that the funding for the Oregon Spirits Board comes directly out of the general fund monies, and also includes some language that the treasurer's office wanted to clarify that the treasury is not paying into the fund, that the OLCC is making those transfers.
Thank you. Committee, I know it's been a while since we've heard this bill, and there was a lot of little technical pieces that we had to work through on this, and it's my intent to move both of these amendments that Jan's expressed or discussed. So, Representative Kinnemer, are you comfortable making a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the Dash 2 amendments.
Representative Kinnemer moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2568. Discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, Dash 2 is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 4 amendments.
Representative Kinnear moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2568. Discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Dash 4 amendments adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kinnear.
I move House Bill 2568 as amended to the floor with the DPAS recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Kinnear moves. Mm-hmm. Moves to pass House Bill 2568 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
No.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you. In the discussions that we did have on the bill, I mean, one of the things that came up was that this product is taxed at 100%. And it's the highest tax of any state in the union, I think, except Washington. And it seems that if we're trying to promote this on a national level in two other states, you know, to bring that tax down to where it was a little more of a level playing field would be advantageous. So I just wanted to, because of that, I was opposed to the bill. My colleague said, no, this is a good bill. You know, don't let that get in the way. So, but I thought I would mention that, you know, if we're trying to promote product from Oregon outside, which is a good thing, and bringing revenue back into the state, then to give it a greater opportunity would be a good thing.
Right. No. I appreciate that. And normally those technical revenue issues might go to the Committee on Revenue, but... appreciate the discussion.
Bring it up.
Representative Kinnemer.
Just one comment. You know, the testimony was we have a flourishing distillers industry and a lot of specialties, and this is, I think, something to support for our small industry in this state. And
thank you. Representative Hurd, your one question.
No. May I have a second question?
No, this is not a question, but go ahead.
Does anybody know when the liquor is sold to another state, say Washington or California, is it taxed by them then, or do we tax it still? Do you know? Does anybody know?
I'd hesitate to guess at that. You can follow up with OLCC and get an answer to that. I don't know that it's directly pertinent to the establishment of this board, but
somebody must know.
Maybe there's somebody in the back that might know.
There he is. Come on up.
It might relieve Representative Barreto's concerns, is my point, as far as the competition aspect.
Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. The answer to the question is that
introduce yourself.
I'm sorry,
for the
Patrick Bernard's from Bull Run Distilling Company. The state of Washington, in that particular case, would tax us, and they are the highest tax in the country. And we get taxed by the state of Oregon only for product going to Oregon. Of course, we pay federal tax on everything. So,
okay, follow up. So, from the competition standpoint, we're not hampered by our tax when it comes to selling out of state.
That's correct. We would not be hampered by our own taxes.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Not seeing any. Matthew, could we have a vote?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Mescalero?
Excused.
Representative Evans?
An enthusiastic yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes. Does cheers count as yes?
Or is your spirit?
Yes.
Representative Nose? Excused.
Representative
Weiner? Yes. I have to.
Excused.
This is a good bill.
Aye. It's a
good bill. Aye. House Bill 2568, having received the votes, is passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2568. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2010 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3377. Jan, would you describe the bills for us, please?
Mr. Chair and committee members, both of these bills are very similar, dealing with flexible and predictable work schedules and giving protections to employees who are discussing them or filing a complaint about them. House Bill 3377 does establish an unlawful employment practice for anyone or discharging or retaliating against an employee who requests, discusses, or files a complaint related to the work schedule. And there is a dash one amendment before you for 3377. We just posted it this morning, and I have some paper copies here if anybody would like it. Very similar to the original bill, but it does apply the requirements for the written notice of the schedule change and for compensation when there's a shift change only to the non-salaried employees. And the dash one amendment also grants the labor commissioner the authority to enforce.
Your chair.
Thank you. Representative Weiner, question.
Are we going to be focused more on 2010 or 3377?
The hearing is open on both.
So, I was wondering which one I should have up.
So up first, the honor calling up the Speaker of the House, Tina Kotek. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, colleagues. Happy Friday to you. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. It's a pleasure to be here this morning on a very important topic. And we have two bills related to a very important issue. And to Representative Widener's question, I think there'll be more emphasis going forward on 3377. But because there are some differences in the bills. But I'm here today broadly to speak about the importance of the issue. There'll be more competent people to talk about the dash one. Glad to hear you have paper. We all remember we just used to get paper amendments. And the world was fine. But this is an important issue, and you know, we have lots of working Oregonians, especially parents with young children, who really face unique challenges in balancing all the responsibilities of home and work. And unfortunately, that balance becomes more difficult if you're in an hourly wage environment where you really have no idea what your schedule is going to be or what your pay is going to be week over week. And that has become a lot more common practice. The reason this issue has come to my attention and my support of working on this issue has been my work on our child care subsidy program, the employment-related daycare program. I think we should always strive here to make our programs that are trying to support families work as best as possible. So we've been having a lot of conversation about that program. And in the course of that discussion, it became very clear to me that even though we are working this session to strengthen the program, make it more predictable for families in terms of when you're in the low-wage workforce and your schedule is erratic and your hours are erratic and your income fluctuates, how do we make the program function better for those families in terms of predictability? We can do that. But the challenge still remains that many families have unpredictable schedules, they have unpredictable paychecks, and for them to be able to schedule on a moment's notice their child care needs, we could build the best program here in the state and hopefully fund it, there would still be a problem. Mm-hmm. And so what is the private sector's responsibility in helping us make a fairer situation out there for families who are trying to make ends meet, trying to work in many cases more than one job, and really just don't know where, when and where they're going to be working on a regular basis and what their paychecks will be. You know, in thinking about this testimony this morning, I was thinking about why are we here in 2015? What has changed in the world? Is it really consumer demand for retail services or the food industry sector or hospitality? Has consumer demand really changed? Maybe a little. Maybe we're more demanding on time service or something like that. But I don't think it's just the consumer side of this. as we've, you know, as you know, during the Great Recession, many businesses had to work very, very hard to squeeze every ounce that they could to make ends meet to stay afloat in the recession. And a lot of large employers in these sectors that the bills address went to just-in-time scheduling to try to maximize that asset they have, the human capital they have, to try to, you know, stay open, make ends meet, and just get through the recession. The challenge is that's been a high cost on the employees in those systems. And it might be time to step back from that and say, what are we doing to the individuals? What are we doing to the relationships with our employees with this just-in-time scheduling? If you, I had to think about this morning. I can't remember the last time I didn't know what my work hours would be. I don't have any children that I need to get in childcare, but if I did, I'd probably have a pretty predictable schedule. I can choose my hours. That is a luxury and a privilege. Many folks do not have that. And so these bills are about having a conversation in the workplace between the employee and the employer to have more predictability so people can plan. And I don't expect that we're going to solve the issue of how many jobs you have to work to make ends meet, you know, tomorrow. So if we have families that need to work one, two, three jobs, they need predictability. They need to be able to know if they can make ends meet and have some way to plan their lives. And that's what these bills are about. So I encourage you to ask hard questions. These bills, there's obviously a dash one on 3377. They need work. But the problem is real. And I encourage the chair to form a work group to continue the conversation after today's hearing. Again, the bills need work. And maybe this is really for larger employers because it's that relationship that has changed. And those multi-state businesses in retail and food service and hospitality have really changed their relationship with their employees. And that has had an impact on our communities, on the children who don't have regular daycare, and frankly, on the families who are just trying to make ends meet. So I encourage you to take this up robustly, and I look forward to the testimonies today. Thanks very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and we have a lot of people to testify, and I'm sure we'll keep working on it. I have a couple of volunteers for a work group already. We've got the far left, Sal Ascovel, and the far right, Rip Sam Nose, I think. And,
may they come together in harmony, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to hang out, listen, so thank you for the opportunity.
That's great.
Representative Nose, a little too conservative
two
for that
colors
group.
That don't blend.
Up next, Representative Fagan, I think you have something to do with this bill, and Andrea Peluso. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51. Thank you for hearing both of these bills today. I certainly was encouraged by the speaker and others to drop these bills, and I think in particular because of my new position, relatively new position, as a mom of a now 2.5-year-old, I've become acutely aware of just how difficult it must be for some families. I only have one kid. I also have a spouse, but we do both work. But we have the luxury many times of having a predictable schedule. But the very few times that I have had an unpredictable schedule, in part mostly due to this job, maybe a Saturday that I need to do something and my spouse works on Saturdays, just that little modicum of stress that I've felt trying to find Saturday daycare has been something that's made me realize, wow, that's some little, you know, tiny little experience that I've felt on a Saturday where it's not something I have to experience every day, but I can't even imagine what it's like for these, you know, particularly women-headed households where maybe they're the only parent or dual spouse or dual parent households, but where they have to constantly deal with that stress because it's very frustrating. And so I introduced these bills really out of my experience as a mom, but certainly looking at the issue more broadly, when workers don't have access to work arrangements that allow them to care for themselves and their family, many get pushed out of the workforce or into jobs that are below their skill level because they maybe are at least able to be more in control of their schedule. I think this is particularly true of women, and women are more likely to be in part-time jobs and low-wage jobs, and in part that's because of the unfair scheduling that kind of pushes them out of jobs that meet their full potential. there's actually 12 other cities and states that have some form of fair scheduling work laws on the books. There's a 9 other cities and states that are actively working towards a campaign. So we're really part of a broad coalition that sees this, as the speaker said, as an emerging issue, and particularly after the Great Recession, because of the kind of the new business practices that are out there that are really exacerbating this issue. Many low-wage workers and hourly workers in our state are unable to predict when they can work, how many hours they'll get per week, and what kind of paycheck they can get. There's also a lot of workers who are now kind of permanently on call, which is just required to be available for 2 hours, up to 2 hours before a shift. So I can't even imagine what it would be like to arrange childcare in that constant environment of being always on call. And they don't have the ability to know what their monthly income will be, which makes it difficult for many of these low-wage workers that maybe need to get a second job. Many of these people are relying on public transportation. So if you have to be ready to work 2 hours before your shift, even if you're not going to work that day, ultimately, you probably have already arranged childcare. You maybe have already gotten on the bus to go downtown to work, because the reality is that's the only way that you can get there. This puts it our Oregonians, our constituents, the people who we serve, in really, really difficult circumstances. And the reality is, for these workers, one day of being called off work or sent home early can mean that they don't have enough money to pay for gas or the groceries at the end of the month. These are people that are really, truly living on the edge. And the fact is that Oregonians are not just workers, right? We're family members, we're caregivers. And particularly today, in the rise of the so-called sandwich generation, when we talk about, obviously I've mentioned childcare a lot, but those are not the only responsibilities. We have Oregonians caring for elderly parents, or maybe, brothers or sisters who are infirm. And so the reality is, Oregonians are a lot more than just workers. They're also family members and caregivers and contributing members of our community. And they need to be able to rely on regular schedules and have the opportunity to arrange work schedules around some of those caregiving responsibilities. And again, to Representative Widener's point earlier, we're really focusing now more on 3377, which really has both sides of the coin, both the flexible and the predictable scheduling. Because the reality is, for some families, they might need the ability to have a flexible schedule so they can work around caregiving responsibilities. But other families might need a predictable schedule so they're able to keep a child in regular, consistent childcare. And again, as a mom there, I can understand that. I mean, my son, if we even have a long weekend like this last one, Mondays are an incredibly difficult drop-off because he's been with us for 3 or 4 days in a row. It's very, very, those are very, very difficult drop-offs because he's not kind of used to the childcare environment anymore. By Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday of that week, he's like begging us to go to childcare because he's kind of once in the groove again. So again, for these families, and really for these kids, to have to constantly maybe be in different childcare environments where they never really get a chance to get settled, get in the groove and get comfortable because their parents don't have a predictable schedule. That's why that's critical for these families. And I also want to make a note that unfair scheduling also harms our students, and particularly our community college students. The stats show that today, 3 in 10 community college students are raising children, and 4 in 10 female community college students are moms. So for these students in particular, who many of them work 25 plus hours a week, and these are hardworking Oregonians, when you want to talk about people that are really making the sacrifices, really the exact kind of Oregonians that we want to fight for, these are people, you know, trying to make a life better for themselves and their kids, attending school, trying to pay for it by working. And these are students that really need those predictable and flexible schedules because they both have school and family and work responsibilities. So finally, I introduced these bills, like I said, as a mom. This is an important issue. And as the speaker said, I really hope that this is the beginning of a robust conversation that ultimately does end in some legislation that can really help these Oregon workers. So thank you for hearing these bills today. Thank you for your attention. And I'll defer to Ms. Peluso for further comments.
Thank you.
Hi, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Peluso. I'm the Executive Director of Family Forward Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of House Bill 3377, the dash ones, and House Bill 2010. We think both of these bills would provide employees with some protection against unfair scheduling practices that currently undermine their ability to provide for themselves and their families, as you've heard. We also believe these protections are especially important to women who make up 65% of Oregon's low-wage workforce, where these scheduling practices are are most common. As you've heard, these women are struggling to care for their families, arrange childcare, schedule doctor's appointments in advance, and other pretty basic things that are a result of what's becoming known as this just-in-time scheduling practices. Practices that also have ripple effects into the rest of their families, into the families of their childcare providers, and a variety of others. We believe that workers should have adequate advance notice of their schedules, be guaranteed some measure of predictability in their schedules, be protected from retaliation for requesting a flexible or predictable work schedule. And we appreciate the opportunity to begin this important conversation today. We wanted to commend the speaker and Representative Fagan for their work on these bills and for their leadership on this important issue. So I wanted to walk you through what the various sections of House Bill 3377, the dash ones, do. So first, Section 1 places the provisions of the bill in the ORS Chapter 653 in our wage and hour laws. Section 2 are definitions, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about those. Sections 3 and 8 establish what we call a right to request provision, which allows employees to request a more flexible or predictable schedule from their employers, without fear of retaliation for making that request. So it also establishes that there needs to be an interactive process between the employer and the employee, where there's some measure of discussion and sort of proof of discussion about why a request would be denied. In very limited circumstances, Section 3 also outlines that an employee would have the right to receive a schedule that they request unless there is a bona fide business reason that the request cannot be granted. And those reasons include the serious health condition of an employee's caregiving responsibilities for a family member, a second job by the employee, or the employee's participation in a career-related or educational training program. We define a bona fide business reason in Section 2.1. This right to request provision is applicable in 3377 to both hourly and salaried employees. We believe all employees should have the right to request a predictable schedule. Section 4 deals with schedule predictability. Unpredictable scheduling happens in a variety of ways, which you've heard. When an employee gives their employees a work schedule with just a few days or hours notice, it also means receiving a work schedule that may be subject to change with little notice, disrupting an employee's out of work responsibilities, often childcare, their ability to have a second job. So Section 4 provides that employees must be provided their work schedule with at least 21 days advance notice, and that changes to an employee's schedule within those 21 days would be subject to some predictability pay, so an additional hour of pay for schedule changes between 21 days and 24 hours before a shift begins. Section 5 establishes some pay for showing up to work. So currently we have employees who are coming into work being sent home without any compensation, or being scheduled for a longer shift for which they've arranged childcare, and then being paid for a much smaller number of hours once they show up to work. And we already have predictability. We already have this kind of pay provision for minors in Oregon law, so we're asking that this provision be extended to adults who are working as well. So this would say that if an employee is scheduled to work a shift of at least 4 hours, that when they show up to work, they should be paid for at least 4 hours. If they're scheduled for a shift that is less than 4 hours, then if they come to work, they should be paid for the number of hours they were scheduled. And there is an exemption in this for shifts that are canceled for reasons beyond the employer's control. I talked a little bit about predictability pay. That's actually in Section 6. So Section 6 talks about a schedule being made given in advance, up to 21 days in advance, and that if a schedule change is made between 21 days and 24 hours, that the employee should be paid an additional hour of predictability pay. If the schedule changes within 24 hours of when an employee is scheduled to work, that they should be given 4 additional hours of predictability pay for schedule changes that happen at that very last minute. We also want to address the issue of employees, particularly employees in big box retail establishments that are being placed on call without any compensation whatsoever, and wanting to establish some predictability pay for the hours that an employee is placed on call, whether or not they're called into work, because as was noted, usually you'd have to schedule childcare for the time that you're on call, regardless of whether or not you come in. You may have heard about some employees who are experiencing something called, there's a new term called clopening, which is employees who are scheduled to both close an employer setting and open an employer setting. So they may be working until midnight when the store closes and then scheduled to work again at 8 a.m. And we believe that scheduling two shifts within one 24-hour period that are not consecutive creates a lot of additional challenge for employees and should be something they're compensated additionally for. And then sections 7 and 8 deal with the enforcement provisions and the retaliation provisions around right to request. So again, we're open to your feedback about how these concepts can be improved. We just want to make sure that we're starting an important conversation about the ripple effects that these just-in-time practices are having on employees, their families, their child care providers, and our broader communities. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you walking through the amendment. That was actually helpful. And there's a lot in this bill at this point. I can see that. Representative Kinnamer, you have a question?
Yeah. Earlier I read there was a limit on the size of employers, but this amendment does not seem to have that.
No, we don't currently have that.
So one employee, you'd be subject to all of this.
Mm-hmm. I think we're wanting to have a broader conversation about which types and sizes of employers this should apply to, without presuming that right now.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, 2010 refers to just retail, hospitality, and food services. 3377 does not.
That's
so,
right.
So it's all inclusive of anyone.
Yes, Representative Barreto, the 3377 does apply to all employees, all employers currently. And House Bill 2010 is specific to retail, hospitality, and food service industries. I mean, I could tell you, too, 2010 is creating the provision around right to request that we discussed, the provisions around right to receive in those circumstances where you have a health condition, caregiving responsibility as a second job. It establishes advance notice requirements on schedules of 2 weeks, whereas 3377 is 3 weeks. It establishes some predictability pay, but only for that window where a scheduling change is made within 24 hours to the start of shift, and it's 1 hour of pay versus 4 hours in 3377. Yeah, I think that's roughly it. So it's has some of the similar provisions, but not as expansive as 3377.
Thank you. I appreciate you starting us out. We've got a lot of people yet to hear from, so thank you very much for bringing this forward.
Thanks.
Representative Fagan, I enjoyed listening to your reasonings. It reminds me of someone else I know who has problems with scheduling because she has to take care of her children. Up next, Rahi Reddy and Melissa Unger.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Kinnamer, and members of the House Committee on Business and Labor. My name is Rahi Reddy, and I'm a faculty member at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. We're here today to share some of our findings on the impacts of erratic and unpredictable scheduling on low-wage working Oregonians we interviewed in our recent report, and just to share a little bit of a snapshot of their experiences. Just-in-time scheduling practices are used for many low-income workers, those who work standard and non-standard schedules, those who work part-time and full-time, and in industries ranging from manufacturing to healthcare. There is some national data on the extent of unpredictable schedules. A number of studies indicate the practice is pervasive. Data from those studies suggests that 50 to 59% of hourly workers experience fluctuations over which they have no control. One recent groundbreaking national survey of workers ages 26 to 32, which included respondents from Oregon, found that 81% of part-time workers reported fluctuations in their work schedules and hours, with 49% reporting they were given 1 week or less of advance notice on work schedules and hours. in our interviews with 44 low-wage working women in Oregon, 54% of them experienced changing work schedules, and 69% worked non-standard hours. And some of these were also subjected to just-in-time scheduling practices. These practices require workers to be on call to receive notification to come to work, sometimes within just a few hours or days' notice. Some workers knew only 1 week ahead what their schedules and hours would be for the following week. Erratic and unpredictable work schedules made childcare arrangements extremely difficult and created instability for families. Shania, one of our interviewees, had to cope with just-in-time scheduling practices. Each week, she found out what days and shifts she would be working the following week. Shania, who worked at a large grocery store, had a difficult time finding providers who would meet her scheduling needs. She notes, a lot of places, they'll only watch kids. Like, some will watch kids on weekends. Some will watch them only up until 6 at night. It's really, really hard to find somewhere that's open weekends and late hours. Ruby worked on a tree farm, and her biggest challenge was flexibility required for a childcare worker. She said, my hours are different every day. It can be really long days sometimes, like in harvest time, we go into the nighttime. So it had to be somebody as a childcare provider to keep certain hours. A lot of babysitters only work from 6 to 6, and sometimes we'd go into work till 8 or 9 p.m. Additionally, unpredictable hours made it harder to predict income week to week. Abby worked at a call center, for example, that demanded complete flexibility. She would have to call in the evening before to see if there was work the next day, and sometimes she was dismissed early if there wasn't sufficient work. Finally, another interview, Athena, was paid by the hour, not by the hour, but by the car in an auto detail business. She found that she lost hours over time. She said, you know, when I start work, I work 45 hours a week, but now I work sometimes 40, sometimes 30 or 35. On slow days, her employer would either send her home early or call her and tell her not to come in at all. She estimated that in some months, her income had reduced by one half, and she was struggling to pay bills. And for some, asking for stable schedules resulted in firings or being forced out of their jobs. When Joyce returned from maternity leave, she was demoted because she could not accommodate a radical shift in her schedule from day shifts to evening shifts. Her employer did not consult with her about the schedule and change and was not willing to negotiate with her, and she had young children at home, including a newborn baby. She felt that the restaurant that she worked at forced her out because she asked for a return to the predictable schedule she had before maternity leave. These are just some of the stories that we wanted to share with you. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director of SEIU Local 503. We represent, along with SEIU Local 49, 65,000 members in Oregon. And we are here to talk about the two bills that are before you on flexible scheduling. And, you know, many of the industries that we represent, healthcare, janitorial, retail, and food services, scheduling has become more and more automated, with less room for flexible schedules. But we also come to this in a way where we represent 4,400 members who are the Friends, Family, and Neighbors program and the employment-related daycare program. And many of these people are doing exactly what we talked about. They are taking care of kids who, parents who have completely unpredictable schedules. And that means that often these folks are neighbors, grandmas, aunts. And the impact of an unpredictable schedule is not just on the worker. It is on the entire family, because if someone wants to go back to work and they have a child, they have to find childcare for their child. And if they work one day at 9 p.m. and the next day at noon, the only people who are going to be able to manage that schedule for the least amount of money is a neighbor who does not work, a grandmother, an aunt, a sister. That is the only person who is going to be able to work around their schedule to make sure that they have a place to put their kid, and in a place where they want it to be safe and secure and trusting. And I think that is where we come to this conversation. I hear stories from our childcare workers all the time of parents who call in a rush to try to figure out where, if they can drop their kid off the next day at a time that was not arranged. They pick up their kid in the middle of the night so that that work child care worker who is can go to work the next morning. It's not just an impact on this worker. It is an impact on a family. And the stress that caused to the child and to the mother and to the child care worker is extreme. And I think that it's a conversation that needs to be had about how we address this, because it impacts an entire low-wage family. And I think as you think about the stress that a low-wage family is under already, trying to pay their bills and trying to make sure that they can make ends meet, and then to add this level of just unpredictability and, I think, fear for what's happening to their child, I think that we should not underestimate how that impacts in a family's ability to really succeed. And I think going back to another comment that was made, this often prevents somebody from trying to get a second job. And if we want people to be able to move out of low-wage work and get a second job or have an opportunity to go back to school if they have no control or predictability around their schedule, that is very difficult to do. And I think so the idea of figuring out ways to make sure that we add predictability and flexibility back into people's schedules are a way to make our jobs more family-friendly, allow to make sure that women can go back to work after having children, and also lift up entire communities. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Kinnemer, question?
Yeah. As I'm looking through this, it gets really very specific. Mm-hmm. And I guess it sounds, at first blush, almost adversarial and litigious. You have 21 days of notice, obviously mm-hmm. something to fight about. You have words like decisions and discussions and requests. Those are pretty nebulous terms, and if we're not careful, it just brings up lots of things, and then there's absolutely no accommodation for variations in types of businesses nor size of businesses, which I think are incredibly important. I have just more of that feedback than a question, because I think it makes it very difficult. And I'm thinking here as a former employer how difficult that would be, and I've had from one employee to a fair number, and those are remarkably different circumstances. And I was thinking, if I were to employ, well, I wish I could afford to employ a housekeeper, I probably would have one, but I probably would need some flexibility, because I'm not sure I want her cleaning the house when I have guests. And a lot of that stuff's pretty short-term in the way most of us live. And 21 days advance schedule changes and written, and then we're supposed to provide them written proof of this. This all moves in a very adversarial place, which I don't think creates the kind of environment that we would want an employment environment to be. I appreciate your indulgence, but I just thought I'd say that.
And yes. Just quickly, Chair Holvey and Representative Kinnemer, I do think that, as other people said, I think this is hopefully the beginning of a conversation, because I do think, I was just talking back there and I was thinking about, what about emergency personnel? Right? I mean, so there, I think this is the beginning of a conversation, ideally, because I do think that there's pieces of this that need further conversations. But I do think the goal is that we would start that conversation and that we would really think about, where do we go from here? Because I think it is an acknowledgement of what you just said, of like, what are the differences in different jobs, but also that it is a problem. And so I think hopefully that this can be a beginning of a conversation, maybe a work group. I don't know what the next step is, but I think that's the goal.
Yeah, and I appreciate the effort, with the bona fide business reason as well, does provide the employer with at least a lot of reasons why they would not grant this. And so I think that that's part of the conversation too, that the employer does have some say-so in this, in the draft anyway, in the dash one. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking in the study and everything that you did at the University of Oregon, I'm sitting here thinking about what are ways that we could help people with this? And one of the things I noticed, like in Chicago, because one of the places where we run into this flexible scheduling is in the hospitality industry. You don't know how many people are going to be in your restaurant that night and everything. You're calling people, trying to get people in and fill them. And I'm wondering if some of this, when we move this, if we can't use technology to change some of these environments. One of the things I noticed in Chicago, and I don't know if you saw this in your study, but restaurants there you would walk into and there weren't servers. I mean, a couple of them that I went to, they went to kiosks where they didn't have to rely on the flexible scheduling or doing it. So maybe by putting something like this forward, we can change how industry is driven and use technology where we don't have to have employees in those applications. Have you noticed anything like that? Because some of the restaurants, literally, you'd go in, you just, they did have one place where you could go up and order, have somebody, and it was a long line to get there. Well, I figured out how to use that kiosk real fast, then I just go over and you grab your food and you're done. So you think, did you look at that when you're doing the study to where we would just get rid of jobs like that and replace it with technology?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, thanks for that question. I think one of the interesting things, and this is, you know, I'm really excited that there is going to be further research and introspection about and understanding about this issue in Oregon. One of the what we've seen and what the studies have shown and kind of some emerging research is how just-in-time scheduling is actually caused by kind of these technological changes in the retail sector, where there is actually, you know, a lot of, you know, there's a computer that basically says, you know, here's the volume of folks that come into a store and how many people would you have to, you know, to predict volume and capacity. And I think, you know, it really is that point where we have to look at what are the human impacts of having, you know, kind of these, you know, technological impetus to set up scheduling when it does impact real people's lives who have to care for children who can't be on call. And so I think it's really looking at all pieces of that and how much of that is a process and a practice here in Oregon. And we would love, through the Labor Ed and Research Center at the University of Oregon, my colleague, Dr. Ellen Scott, who conducted these interviews, we would love the opportunity to do more interviews, to do more research, to support kind of the, you know, the study that you all are thinking about, because we would want to spend more time learning about the Oregon experience.
Thank you, and I really would like to. We have a lot of people to testify. We're going to run past 10 o'clock as it is now, and I really do want to hear the testimony as well. We could probably ask questions of just one panel for the rest of the morning. So I'd like to get kind of a and I think this conversation is going to continue. So thank you. Up next, Bill Perry, Valerie Stinson, and Keith Folkestad.
Close enough.
Folkestad. I'm not known for getting names right, so apologize for that.
That's all right. Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Holvey. Members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry from the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. I appreciate the time this morning. I think the discussion was kind of going where it needs to, you know, I think the bill tries to say we want predictability and flexibility, and you're not going to be able to achieve that in one piece of legislation in all industries. And I would say the thing that I think has been harped on this is there are a majority of our employees that like the flexibility that our industry provides. Last meeting when we testified, in college towns, people love four-hour shifts that they can move around on a short notice. There are in the standby shifts with start times but not end times, you'll have employees every day that come in, can I be the first one off, can I be the last one off, and the employer has a flexibility to adjust that. Once again, I think employees like that. Also, there's a lot of short shifts in the afternoons, specifically because there's kids at daycare, and you know, people that are caring for their children can come in short, so they can be there when their kids go to school and when they get off. So our industry is built around trying to be flexible and moving in many places for to adjust those, and that's what the industry is built around for the most part, and we've made those adjustments. If you've got more than 25 employees, you're going to have multiple people every day that basically want to change. They're sick. Their kids have got something. So, I mean, it's one of those things where as you put more and more restrictions on a business on how they deal with that, you actually, in my opinion, make it less flexible for the employer to adjust to those moving targets. And once again, by making the requirement under certain circumstances, you really take the negotiation out of it because you put the specific employee at basically the advantage. And remember, this bill makes it sound like it's an employee and an employer, but once again, if you've got 25 employees that are coming in on a shift and three or four of them negotiate, that takes a lot of administrative time to do. And once again, there's ways that this can be set up. So stuff that's going on today, technology is a benefit because they have apps that you can do shift trading on. You have reservation systems that you use, which actually a high amount of people don't end up showing up for, which creates additionals. But I do want to, you know, kind of close before I let these two people go, is the one thing about this is a perfect example of what is frustrating with the hospitality industry. It's April. It's Friday in April, and it's sunny outside. If you're on the coast in a hotel, your business is probably going to bump 20 to 30% tomorrow. I mean, people are going, it's nice outside, I'm going to be able to go to the coast, I'm going to get a 20 to 30% bump in business in some of those communities. Okay, in Friday, all of a sudden the weatherman comes out and it says it's going to rain tomorrow. Golf courses in the Willamette Valley are going to see a 50% disruption in their business, a decline. Whether or not it rains or not, you're going to see your T-sheet just plummeting. And that's the thing about this industry, is it ebbs and flows, especially in this time of year. Summer usually full, winter you're going to have frustrations depending on where you're at. But in the fall and the spring, you're going to see disruptions in your business like you can't imagine. And once again, you want me to be flexible for my employees, which our employers do as much as they can, but you also have to remember the flexibility also applies for the employer, because weather in this state is problematic for a business. And so if you try to the more you try to make things predictable, I would argue the more flexibility you take out of my ability to work with my employees. And it's just, it's what's is. I agree with everything that was says of employers should be doing what they can to work with these people, and I would say they do, but there are just certain factors that play into it, and every industry you're going to hear is completely different the way this works. So with that, I don't know if you want to connect.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Stinson, and I'm the Director of Human Resources for the Old Spaghetti Factory Restaurants. While we understand the importance of providing employees with advance notice and flexibility in their schedules, we're confused about the purpose of the House Bill 2010 is what I've focused on. I know there's some similarities, and we have some concerns, such as the impact the law will have on our ability to effectively staff our restaurants to provide excellent guest service, the financial impact it will have on our business, and the potential that employees will abuse this policy and view it as entitlement. So I want to kind of go through some of the sections of the bill and point out what our concerns are. So Section 2.1a states, an employee may request a flexible, predictable, or stable work schedule from the employee's employer. The bill doesn't stipulate what that means. When can they make that request? Is it referring to at the time we hire them, any time during the course of their employment with us? Are there parameters to the request? Does it have to be in writing? Do they have to give us any advance notice? And we're concerned that employees will abuse this policy or this law. Unfortunately, employees take advantage of systems and benefits. There's no provision in the bill that stipulates that we can require documentation to prove the reason that they're asking for a revised schedule. Section 21C states, the employer is not obligated to provide an alternate work schedule for the employee after engaging in the interactive process unless the employee has requested a flexible, predictable, or stable work schedule because of A, a serious health condition of the employee, B, caregiving responsibilities for children or the elderly, C, a second job, or D, the employee's participation in educational or job training programs. We already currently abide by laws that require us to provide time off to employees for medical reasons. There's the Federal Family Medical Leave Act, the Oregon Family Leave Act, the now Portland Earned Sick Leave, possibly Oregon Sick Leave. We don't understand why there needs to be another law that would cause confusion and possibly further complicate the administration of leave and unmodified schedules due to health reasons. We already work with our employees to help them juggle multiple jobs. This bill appears to give more credence to the employee's other job, and it lessens the importance of the employee being committed to our business. It doesn't seem fair or realistic. What determines which job has the most importance? Which job supersedes which in terms of scheduling? And we already work with our employees to provide flexible schedules so they can go to school. Again, this bill appears to give more credence to the employee's education than to their responsibilities to working for us on the job. Section 22A states, an employer in the retail, hospitality, or food services industry shall provide each employee with the employee's work schedule at least 2 weeks prior to the work schedule becoming effective, and on or before a new employee's first day of employment shall provide the employee with the employee's work schedule and the number of hours the employee can expect to work. We already post schedules 2 to 3 weeks in advance, but there are bona fide business reasons which might require us to make changes with less than 2 weeks' notice, and Keith will go into some examples of that. And it's not realistic for us to post a schedule 2 weeks prior to a new hire's first day of employment. Sometimes we interview somebody, make them a job offer, and hire them in 3 or 4 days. So there's no way we can do that. Section 22B states, after an employee in the retail, hospitality, or food services industry has been provided notice of the employee's work schedule, if the employee's work schedule is changed by the employer with less than 24 hours prior notice, the employer shall pay the employee one additional hour's wages at the employee's regular rate of pay for each shift changed, unless the shift change was the result of unexpected availability of another employee. As a restaurant, our mission is to provide an exceptional dining experience to our guests. We're in business to serve guests, people. This means that our schedules are based on how many guests are expected. We try our best to predict how many guests we will serve each shift, but guests don't always plan ahead, and sometimes they change their minds. For example, we might have a 40-person banquet on the books, and the party might call and cancel with less than a day's notice, or the party might not show up at all. When something like this happens, we have to modify our staffing schedule. It's impractical and financially burdensome to expect a business to incur additional payroll expense on top of having possibly lost sales. Section 22C. If an employee in the retail, hospitality, or food services industry is required to call in to work less than 24 hours prior to the scheduled start of a work shift to ascertain if the employee is required to report for that shift, or if an employee is required to work a daily schedule in which the hours worked are not consecutive, the employer shall pay the employee one additional hour's wages at the employee's regular rate of pay. I know there are other industries that use on-call scheduling, so I'm confused why this bill only singles out retail, hospitality, or food services industries. While we don't typically schedule double shifts or split shifts, there are times that employees request to work or pick up double shifts. We don't understand why the employer should have to pay an additional hour of pay when the employee is asked to work a double or split shift. And in our industry, we rely on-call shifts in order to manage the precarious nature of guest numbers. Paying an additional hour of pay for every on-call person scheduled would create a financial hardship for us. The bill is unclear as to whether we would have to pay every person that's on call, just the people on call that we don't call in, just the people who are on call that we do call in. But conservatively, in the 4 Oregon restaurants that we currently own and operate, we schedule 7 people on call per restaurant every day. That equates to $1,813 per week, or $94,276 per year. We're opening a 5th restaurant in Sherwood in September. With 5 Oregon restaurants, the cost to us would increase to almost $118,000 per year that we'd have to pay just to be running our business. And this is on top of the costs that we've recently had to incur with Portland earned sick leave, which is $3,000 last year, expected to be $4,000 this year. The financial impact would significantly hinder our ability to continue to offer value, pricing, and competitive pricing to our guests. So I'd like to conclude by saying that we don't understand the reasoning behind the proposed law. It would add just another layer of administrative requirements to the already burdensome task of coordinating the existing laws that we currently follow. We don't feel it's necessary because our employees already have flexibility in their schedules, and we already give them advance notice. So Keith Folkstad, who's our district manager for Oregon, is going to provide some more specific scheduling circumstances for you.
Chairman Holby, representatives of the committee, thank you. Yeah, I've heard a lot about human capital today. And excuse me, please. Keith Folkstad with the Old Spaghetti Factory. Heard a lot of discussion about human capital and the importance of scheduling and predictability for employees, which I think we all agree is a great idea. The Old Spaghetti Factory, we provide a predictable schedule. We provide a schedule that's posted 2 to 3 weeks out. We use technology to allow our staff flexibility. At any time, at 2 a.m., sitting in their living room playing Xbox, your 20-year-old kid can swap a shift with a 30-year-old mother. Not a problem. I don't understand the benefit of making the restaurant pay an additional $9.25 an hour when we make a minor change to the schedule. If you schedule a reservation at the Old Spaghetti Factory and you get caught up in committee and you have to change your reservation to a half hour later, I need to be able to call the staff and say, hey, can you come in 30 minutes later? Well, under the proposed bill, we now have to pay those two people who are going to come in to take care of you an additional $9.25 an hour. They're not losing money. They're going to wait on you. It'll take the same amount of time. I'm unclear as to why there's an additional burden on the restaurant for that. Most of my points have already been addressed by Val and Bill, but I would say that there are weather-related issues. Mother's Day, Father's Day, the sun comes out, people barbecue. They don't come to the restaurant to eat. So our business might drop by 30%. We closed 4 Oregon restaurants last February for 4 days due to weather. Do I need to pay on that first day $9.25 to everybody who's on the schedule because we didn't open? We had a power outage not too long ago. Do I need to pay $9.25 to everybody who was scheduled because we had a power outage? So these are things that I think about. We obviously want to be the employer of choice, and we work very hard to do that. We believe that we provide an appropriate level of flexibility. We have mothers who like to compress their schedule and work at a time that's convenient for them that fits their family. So we engage the team members, our employees, in a flexible schedule discussion at the time of hiring. And if their circumstances change, we listen to what they have to say, and we make the appropriate adjustment so that it's a win-win. That's all I have to say. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your perspective, and thank you for testifying. Up next, I got a note. Somebody has to leave at 10. Art Towers.
Is this flexible scheduling, Mr. Chair?
Introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm testifying in favor of both of these bills. Many of you may have the perception of the Oregon Trial Lawyers as the group of lawyers that does class action lawsuits, and many others of you, when you think about OTLA, may envision the attorneys who help people who are injured in car wrecks. Others, when you think about OTLA, may think of Representative Barton. But the many of our members help workers who've been discriminated against, who've been wrongfully terminated, who've been victims of discrimination based on age or gender, family status, disability, whistleblower issues, retaliation for filing workers' comp claims, those sorts of things. And those members of ours have flagged this issue as a very important one. And I concur with many of the comments that figuring out the right solution to this challenge will be a daunting task. But I really appreciate the committee's willingness to look into this and dig into this and take it as the serious problem that it is. I want to close my testimony by speaking about a situation that's very close to home for me. My daughter has been subject to this situation where on Friday she finds out for the upcoming week the shifts that she'll work as a restaurant manager. She will work 5 a.m. to 2 p.m. A couple days a week. She'll work 10 to 6 a couple days a week. She'll work 5 p.m. to 2 a.m. a day or two a week. Fortunately, she doesn't have the clopidogrel problem, but the schedule that has really had a bad effect on her granddaughters and on her daughters. She stayed in a bad marriage too long because she needed the job that had the health care, even though the job itself was really harming her family. The scheduling was really harming her family. I watch the impact on her daughters, on my granddaughters, and they really need more out of their mom than she can offer working that schedule. The other observation I would make, I love her dearly, but when she works that schedule and is perpetually exhausted, her decision making is not what it needs to be. And I worry about the impact on families in the situation. Thank goodness my wife's, as you can imagine, has to be a saint, but in a lot of different ways. But caring for the granddaughters, is the godsend. And so my daughter's been able to get out of the marriage here 10 days ago. She was able to find a different job. And just in the last 10 days, seeing the difference it's made to have a regular 9-to-5 job that doesn't quite pay as much but has a set schedule, has already made a difference with our granddaughter. So I'll conclude there. Happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Earls.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, again, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and appearing in opposition to House Bill 3377 in 2010. Thank you so much for letting me testify now. I have to be the same place as Arthur. We both have to be at MLAC starting at 10, so I really appreciate it. I think both of these bills probably are going to go through significant redrafting processes before they ever, become law if they do. And right now they're both written to apply to a number of different employers. So I think I'll just speak sort of generally to the issue. And since they apply to so many different types of employers, I just wanted to focus on one, which is the retail industry. As you know, AOI represents also a number of retailers in Oregon. And retailers use the kind of predictive scheduling models that have been talked about here this morning already quite a bit. The first point I would make is that retailers employ a lot of people, as Mr. Perry mentioned, who are very interested in flexible schedules, shorter work schedules, that are students, and that value the ability to work with their employers to change schedules when they need to. Our members recognize that their greatest asset is their employees, and their employees' preferences and needs are really a high priority when they're planning schedules. The thing is, there's a flip side to the whole scheduling problem, which is that they need to also take into account a lot of external factors that affect the way their businesses run. When they're developing employee schedules, retailers have to consider a wide variety of factors, and most of them are not particularly predictable. Those include most particularly weather, as you've already heard, but also the productivity of the store in that given week or month, historic payroll and hour reports, their workload, marketing or in-store events, which are more predictable, upcoming holidays, again, which are also more predictable,
And I think I mentioned weather. one of the most frequent occurrences and one that causes problems for our members frequently when it comes to scheduling is the just-in-time scheduling that retailers need to use in order to get product on the shelves. They are frequently receiving product, of course, at the last moment. That product could be coming from a long way away. And can the arrival of that product at the store can really be impacted by weather, even in another state, or traffic problems, even in another state. And they can end up in a situation where they have several employees, especially around holiday times, that have been scheduled to come in and work, not just to unload those trucks, but also to help sell the product, to maintain a consistent level of service in the store. And at the very last minute, or maybe an hour or two in advance, the product doesn't arrive for whatever reason. So it's only one example, and I only offer it to you to make the point that there are a lot of variables that shift right up until the day, frequently, that somebody is expected to work. So while I understand that there are a lot of there are genuine, legitimate needs that employees have as far as some more stability in their work schedules, the length of time out that these bills would place, that these bills would require a schedule to be published and firm, are pretty difficult for especially retailers to meet. I think it's 3 weeks, and we would ask at some point, if we're moving forward with these bills, to look at something shorter than that. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, and good luck in getting to where you need to go.
We're going.
Up next, Steve Johnson and Sean Tate. And maybe I could get Scott Winkles to come up too. See here. Go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Tate here today on behalf of the Salem Area Chamber of Commerce and its more than 1,200 member businesses. I appreciate the opportunity this morning to provide our perspective on these bills. Have done so this morning with a letter submitted for the record, so I will keep my comments brief and save you a verbatim reading, as it were. While certainly sympathetic to the needs of employees and families as they relate to childcare and other issues, the Chamber sees some challenges with both 2010 and 3377, as you might imagine, and equally, perhaps if not more importantly, is concerned about the cumulative effects of this and similar legislation on the ability of the Salem area and certainly the state to attract, conduct, and grow business and industry. With respect to the bills at hand, I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce the gentleman to my right. Steve Johnson is president and CEO of Vips Industries, headquartered here in Salem. Vips owns and operates 6 hotels, 1 restaurant, and a convention center, and I've asked Steve here today to provide his perspective on this legislation.
Steve Johnson. Sean has already introduced me. I wanted to share a little bit about my history first so that I can hopefully have you attach some credibility to our perspective for both myself and my company because of the experience. So we're Vips Industries, Inc., and Sean just indicated we currently own and operate a number of hotels here in Oregon and restaurants. We're actually a Salem headquartered company, started in 1968. We've been in business 47 years. We've owned upward of 70 restaurants in 5 states at any given time, employing up to 5,000 people at any given time. In our current configuration, we have, as I said, there are 8 operating properties with about 350 employees all here in the state of Oregon. So we've been dealing with this for a long time. And when I say dealing, I mean to say we've had experience with and do exactly that which we're talking about here with respect to scheduling employees in serving our guests. I've personally been doing this in my capacity for 34 years And so together with my own personal experiences, that is as well as that of our company, I think we have a pretty good perspective and handle on this entire situation, and I want to share that perspective with you. Before going to the practical applications and illustrations, I'd like, though, to take an opportunity here to challenge two premises, both implicit and explicit, in these conversations that I've been hearing today and incorporated in every aspect of this legislation. The first would be the premise that there's an adversarial relationship between management and staff in the hospitality business in both our restaurants and hotels, and further, that it is the employer that has the power to rule arbitrarily and abusively in establishing work schedules, and the employee has no options. I'm compelled to correct the record and that perception. We haven't been in business for 47 years. We haven't employed tens of thousands of people by being abusive towards them. It is a teamwork scenario. It is a cooperative relationship. Every single employee that's ever come to work for us has walked into our doors and asked us for a job. We do not conscript. We don't compel anybody to be there. Everybody is there of their own free will and choice, knowing full well what the requirements are going to be of working in hospitality business. Similarly, the employee has the opportunity, without notice, without reason, and without consequence, to leave their employment with us if it doesn't work for them or their particular circumstances or conditions. And I think that's really important to understand. We really have a level playing field. We work in a very flexible environment. We work with each other to develop a situation where we can serve our guests, which is our primary mission. I can't overstate that, because it is clear in everything that has been testified to today that the presumption is that it is an abusive relationship, and every scenario that has been presented to you has been one wherein it's clear that there has been advantage taken by the employer. I even see, I hear, there's a term of art coined already for that which is going on here. It's unfair scheduling practices, capital U, capital S, capital P. I don't know what that means. I haven't heard that. I resent my staff being characterized as engaging in unfair scheduling practices. It's an interactive process. It is predictable. We do present schedules. We do maintain that schedule, subject to variation required both on the employee's part as well as on the management part, based on flow of business. The characterization of the practice being pervasive is, again, offensive. This is what we do, and it works for our people, and it works for our customer. The requirement that people be on call is nonsensical. People aren't on call. They're given a schedule. The assumption that people are receiving these notices of their schedule with a matter of hours or days and it changes is nonsensical and inaccurate, in fact. We actually do present a schedule for a full week in advance. We do that 3 to 5 days in advance of that week. But that schedule is consistent with the schedule they had the week before, the week before, the week before. There isn't the level of unpredictability that has been expressed here today. This is, in fact, a mutually beneficial, genuinely cooperative and flexible relationship. The second premise here that I'm just compelled to dispel is that those current practices, as we execute them, not as has been represented here, that may occur in particular occasions, there are bad apples everywhere, is a bad thing. It's a good thing. In point of fact, it is our industry that presents an extremely unique and hardly repeatable opportunity for flexibility for individuals based upon every single one of these needs that has been expressed as the basis for presenting this legislation. The need for part-time employment, a second job, this being the second job, not being the primary job, the other being the primary job. Student status, child care limitations, weekend requirement, evening employment. It is this industry that provides that opportunity and the flexibility to these folks. This has been characterized as an issue in Oregon. The issue in Oregon are some very serious ones that have been expressed: marital status, lack of education, lack of skill training, mm-hmm. child care responsibilities. Those are very serious issues. But those are the issues, not the work scheduling of the hospitality industry. And I need to make that very, very clear. I'm the one that's been doing this for 34 years. I appreciate the laudable goal of several people who have testified here to try to address those social and economic concerns. But the place to address them isn't by changing the current staffing practices of the hospitality industry. Beyond that, I'm going to conclude with just echoing the comments that are already made by the Old Spaghetti Factory people here, in that it just needs to be appreciated again that the primary mission to be executed by the staff representing both employer and employee in the hospitality business is not to suit, frankly, the needs and purposes of the employer, not to suit the needs and purposes of the employee, but in fact to serve our guest. That is our primary mission. Our guest is not there 9 to 5. Our guest doesn't provide appointments weeks in advance. Our guest shows up at our doorstep in our restaurant on a whim, at lunch or at dinner, and we've got to be there to serve them. We have a window in our restaurant, 12 to 2, 5 to 9 for dinner. In our hotel, we've got 80 guests at night. They stay. They check it out at 8 o'clock. We got 80 more coming in at 3 o'clock. We have to clean those rooms between 8 o'clock and 3 o'clock. We can't say that doesn't work for your schedule, and so why don't you come in at 6 and clean some rooms? That isn't how it works. That isn't unfair. One should not choose this industry as their employment if it won't work for their need. As the one gentleman testified, quite correctly so, his daughter was severely challenged by the staffing schedule she had at, I'm assuming, a restaurant that she was employed by. That was wrong for her. That wasn't right. I would agree 100%. The first thing she needed to do was leave and find that 9-to-5 job she did. That is exactly what should occur. Take advantage of your opportunity to leave and find that which works for you. But we don't solve that problem that poor gal had by changing the staffing practices of the restaurant that does have to be open at 5:30 in the morning.
Thank you.
That's all I have to say.
Appreciate it. And I'm sure this bill wasn't meant to characterize your individual business, so I apologize if it seems that it does. Go ahead.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles appearing on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I was pleased to hear earlier comments that there was going to be a longer conversation, that this was the beginning of a conversation and potentially a work group. We do have some concerns with both bills and specifically how they would interact with the collective bargaining statutes, because wages, hours, terms, and conditions of employment, these are all mandatory subjects of bargaining. And we can't have a CBA, a collective bargaining agreement, that conflicts with state law. And so if you have an employer, we negotiate We negotiate hours, positions, there's seniority bidding rights associated with it, and then we create a requirement to enter into an agreement. I think there's some we're not sure at this point as to how this statute and what's in PECBA would interact, and I believe we should continue those conversations and resolve that. Additionally, I point out that cities provide services that just have to get done. We have to have cops on the street. We have to have people at the wastewater treatment plant, or really bad things happen. So making sure that the employer is an employer, even for those folks who are not representative, we can still meet those public needs, those vital public services, is going to be very important to us.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning. It was good to hear.
Thank you.
Up next, John Zielinski, Roger Beyer, and Sean Miller. Good morning, gentlemen. You introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning.
Roger, you want to start?
Go ahead.
Chair Holvey, committee, my name is John Zielinski. I farm just northeast of Salem here. I am the Labor Committee Chair for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I have a short statement. I was used to coming in when these things are, they give you a very small window of time, but then I made some notes to make up for that as the other folks were speaking. In addressing some of the issues in House Bill 2010 and 3377, there are bona fide reasons listed. And as it reads, we understand that harvest of a crop probably would fall under that. And though harvest would be recognized as a bona fide reason to exempt an employer from the law, there are many other activities in agriculture that would be difficult at best if these bills are implemented. In agriculture, we work with what Mother Nature gives us for opportunities. We do not sit in an office until harvest. No, there are many times in the year where we are in a crunch time due to weather or other natural timing restrictions. Spring ground prep and planting is often has a tight timeline. Just look at the weather that we've had recently. Nice one day, raining the next. And this has been a dry year. In a typical year, the weather opportunities to get fields worked and crops planted are even fewer. As farmers, we generally do not have an HR department. I can envision a blueberry farm that may have 100 employees for a two-month time frame. In that 2 months, they might pick 5 different varieties of blueberries. And in that time, trying to predict 21 days in advance the ripeness, the weather, the consumer demand, it's impossible. In 2010, it is listed as 15 employees or more. That might sound like, okay, if you hit 15 employers or more, you're a mid to larger business. And in ag, most months of the year, we do employ less than 15. Most farms, I would say in Oregon, employ less than 15 people. But they might, during harvest time, have well over 100 people out there to pick. Trying just the human resources element of trying to come up with schedules in advance, to work with all that, whether it be spring planting, summer care of the crops, or harvest, it would be virtually impossible. There's also the support industries of agriculture. We grow tree fruit, packing apples, things like that are based on demand, oftentimes on the East Coast or in other places, or foreign markets. 21 days in advance scheduling would not be a workable situation. 4-hour work requirement and pay would be also very difficult due to nature. There are mornings when strawberries cannot be picked because it rains. It would be very burdensome to an employer who has 50 people show up to pick strawberries that all of a sudden he has to pay them for a 4-hour shift because it rained. Or for the same thing for pruning in the winter, if you want to exclude harvest. We prune our trees every winter. The employees know to show up every day. However, they arrive in the morning, and if it's raining, hey, we'll leave it up to you guys. If it's raining too hard, go home. We'll check again after lunch, and they come back. I would echo some of the comments by one of the previous speakers, just previous to me, in that if it's not the right industry for you, then you shouldn't be there. And I thought those were some fabulous comments. I also wanted to state that I did a little research in back as I was listening to the others, that the unemployment rate right now is 6.7% in Oregon, the lowest since July of 08. It's a right-to-work state. So, again, echoing that, if it's not the right industry for you, then please find a different industry to work in, and maybe it will be a better fit for you. I also heard it mentioned that this is the start of a conversation. As a citizen of Oregon, I would hope that more effort and time is put into the bills that are submitted. I know that give and take is needed to make this sausage grinder work. But to submit a bill that is unworkable and is not a good use of state resources and mine or the other people here's time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing multiple clients today. I'll start with my agricultural clients. It would be the Oregon Seed Council, the Oregon Dairy Farmers, and the Oregon Blueberry Commission. I think we would agree with much of what John just said for most of those clients, but in addition to that, the Oregon Dairy Farmers, where they don't have a harvest per se, they milk cows don't wait to be milked. They have to be milked every 8 or 12 hours, depending on the schedule that the farmer has set up. So they can provide a more predictable schedule in that arena, but at the same time, there are also issues that happen that they cannot predict. Weather, cow health, other things all come to mind. So it would be very difficult if you have to have these kind of requirements on that industry. What Mr. Linsky said about the rest of agricultural and harvest, I think is very appropriate. But when we talk harvest, we have to be careful. Many times people think of harvest and they think of a perishable crop. In the world of grass seed is not considered a perishable crop, but yet it needs to be harvested in a very timely manner, or it becomes just as worthless as a blueberry that rots on the vine. So those are issues that need to be thought of as this bill moves forward, if this bill moves forward. You got the gavel?
I had to take a picture of that.
Thank you. So with that, I will stop on the agricultural side, but I'd like to bring up a couple other of my clients. We would be the insurance agents I represent, both the Independent Agents of Oregon and the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. These are mainly small businesses in Oregon, and one bill, House Bill 2010, does exempt businesses with 15 employees or less. The other bill, as I read it, or the Dash 1 amendments, does not. When you have very small retail or office environments, much as many of these are, 1, 2, 3, 5 people, insurance agencies, you have to have someone at the front desk to answer the phone calls and greet people when they come through the doors. And again, while it is very much easier to make a predictive schedule, if something changes, if someone gets sick, or if one other employee doesn't show up, you need to call someone in to be that, be there to cover that spot. Those are real-time things that happen on a daily basis in small businesses. So to be able to, or be required to not ask people to come in or pay penalties if they don't or cancel if something changes would just be a great burden on those very small employers. So I'd like to think about that as this bill gets worked in a work group. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to take any questions.
We have more panel members, Jan.
I don't think Sean's spoken.
Yeah.
No, Sean hasn't gotten
talked
yet.
It's all right.
We have more relevant.
I'm not sure I wouldn't have done that.
Mr. Chair.
Don't take it personally.
Did he talk?
Please take the gavel.
I forgot Sean.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association and the Portland Business Alliance. We're here in opposition to House Bill 2010 and House Bill 3377. And I'll just abbreviate my testimony, Mr. Chair. But, you know, schedules are based on employee availability as well as our business needs. In addition to employee preferences and the availability, multiple data points are used to create schedules, including the sales forecasts, productivity of a store, the historic payroll and hour reports, workload, transportation when trucks are coming in to, for deliveries, and customer traffic patterns. Schedules may change in response to sales fluctuations and other factors that drive workload. You've already heard of some of the weather factors. The further out schedules are required to be posted, the less accurate the forecasting model becomes. This could cause problems in predicting staffing to meet the needs of our customers, which will ultimately has the adverse impact of taking flexibility away from our employees. In conclusion, Mr. Chair, I think every company is unique in their business processes, and these proposals fail to contemplate the unique differences in different businesses. And I just want to add that I know scheduling is also really a part of the collective bargaining agreements, and so some of the companies that I represent, you know, that is a discussion that is very involved in those CBA agreements and those discussions, and so just want to point that out. But again, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate the discussion from Madam Speaker and Representative Fagan to bring this discussion. We would much rather have this discussion at a statewide level. Even I'm here today, although opposing these bills, I would much rather be having a discussion here versus the pattern of going from city to city and having these issues brought up in sittings, so we continue to have that patchwork of employee-related differences around our state. So again, appreciate the conversation. Happy to participate in any work group in the future. But again, I think in my conclusion is it's one of the reasons why we're asking for kind of a statewide preemption on these kind of issues, so we can have these conversations here and not driven by policy, but from a few cities. So with that, Ms. Chow, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, if I could have just a moment, I saw another note that I had written down here, and that is, again, it's John Zielinski for the record. Farmers are very family-oriented businesses and people. It's oftentimes our family that are our first employees. I farm with my two brothers. I have had numerous nieces and nephews work for me. So when an employee comes to me with a need, whether it be family or any other employee, if they have a sick child or anything like that, we work with them because we understand the importance of family and the dynamics of family. So I just wanted to make that statement that farmers are, family is everything to them. It's often the continuation of their business. It's where they probably receive their business from. So we understand and definitely value the family that is the reason for these bills being put forward.
Thank you. Yes, I believe we all come from families and share your sentiment. Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll take care of it later. Up next, Tricia Smith. Is that the last one?
Yep.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I'm here in support of both bills and the Dash 1 Amendment to House Bill 3377. You've heard much testimony today, and I'll try to keep my comments brief, although I think what I have to say is slightly different than what you've heard before. One of the segments of the workforce that OSEA represents are private sector employees who work under contract with public sector education institutions. For example, school bus drivers who work for private sector companies and provide school bus transportation to school districts. The problems that you've heard addressed today exist more broadly than just in the retail and hospitality industries. They also exist amongst organized workers in the workforces that we represent. One segment of our membership, as I told you, are these private sector bus drivers. At one time, school bus drivers were full-time employees. They worked the school year and received unemployment benefits during the summer and came back every year, and they worked a full career as a school bus driver. That's what they did. Today, they're part-time employees. They work a split shift during the day. They're low-wage workers. They receive no unemployment during the summer. They don't have paid sick days or time off. And so they schedule their personal business on scheduled days off. Whether they're taking a child to the doctor or seeing other professionals that they have to address in their personal lives, they plan to do that on their days off. So when their schedule is changed quickly, unpredictably, that puts some serious problems in their personal life. Recently, one of our units was required to attend a mandatory meeting on a school holiday, when they know that they will not be working. They also, by the way, do not receive holiday pay for that day, but they know that they will have that day off. So our members schedule their personal business on that day. One of our members had to take his wife to OHSU for treatment of a life-threatening illness, and he scheduled it on that day. With less than a week's notice, they were told that they must attend this mandatory meeting, which was occurring because when they had attended a mandatory training a few months earlier, their employer did not create the proper records to show that the training had occurred, so they had to come to this meeting and sign forms and make sure that all the record keeping was correct for this training. The employees asked that had personal business that they didn't feel they could reschedule asked to be exempted from this meeting and were told that they could not be exempted, and if they didn't show up, that there would be disciplinary measures taken. To put these people in this situation is simply unfair. This is not a weather-related, unpredictable situation. This is not the situation I'm describing. It's not something that was beyond the employer's control. We believe those situations can be addressed in legislation. What this bill is trying to address is the situation I'm describing to you. The workers who have no choices. They are fearful of losing the only job that they have. They can't get a second job because they have a split shift and they must be available for their primary employer. And so they are forced to sacrifice the needs of their families to keep the only job that they must have because they don't have a nest egg either. They're low-wage employees. One of our members on that holiday was here in this building testifying before you about her need for paid sick days. She didn't go to that mandatory meeting so that she could come here, as she had planned to do. We still don't know the full consequence of her not coming to that meeting, but there will be consequences to her, even though it was a holiday and she expected to be off. Low-wage workers, even those with union contracts, feel that they have no choices. This bill gives them a tiny bit of power to ask their employers to work with them so that they can meet both the needs of their employer, which they believe are important, and the needs of their family, which at least are equally as important. You've heard some real-life stories today about workers and the effect that the current situation has on them, including my own members. And you've also heard some real-life stories of workplaces and the difficulty in being a business today and staying alive as a business. both of those things are very, very important for you to consider. They are not mutually exclusive.
Right.
You've also heard testimony today about some concerns with this bill that, if you read the bill, you'll see are addressed. So please read the amendment as you consider the testimony. And then the last thing I'd ask you to consider is, in situations where an employer feels that he or she needs to bring employees in some way that no one had planned, should the employee bear the full cost of that unpredictability? That's the situation we have today. And where it comes home the most often is with those workers who have the least choices. And that's wrong. So help us put together a bill that works for businesses and workers. And I'll be standing there with you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. I think you have laid out our challenge. I think we've heard some legitimate concerns on both sides of this topic, and a real difficult path we must look at. And I do think this will take a bit more conversation than we're going to have the capacity to do in a short period of time. And there's going to have to be a lot of conversations around this topic. So. Appreciate everybody's attention, committee. I appreciate you staying over a little bit longer since we had an opportunity to finish this this piece. I don't think there was anybody else signed up to testify. Again, thank you all for your input. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2010 and close the public hearing on House Bill 3377. And Jan, anything else on our agenda?
No.
Hopefully.
Committee, have a good weekend, and we'll see you bright and early Monday morning. With that, I adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. Committee on Business and Labor.